Welcome, friends and fiends. This is your host, film critic and comedian Nate Wyckoff, and I'm here to tell you about an exciting giveaway that Warner Brothers Discovery and Colton Classic Films LLC has put together to build your 4K Ultra HD film collection on digital. We are giving away four codes which contain digital 4K Ultra HD versions of Rebel Without a Cause, Maltese Falcon, and Cool Hand Luke. These are films that you absolutely must know as a film buff. You can get this code by being one of the lucky four people we pull from our newsletter list. So go to ColtonClassicFilms.com/newsletter and give us your email and your name, and we'll sign you up for the newsletter and we will enter you in the competition. That's all you got to do. So please go ahead and do that. The contest ends on April 30th and we will send out the winning codes on May 1st. Thank you so much for being a listener. And here's your episode of Colton Classic Films Podcast.
Welcome to Cult and Classic.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Cult and Classic. We have an awesome lineup for you this week of hairy double features, or rather one hairy double feature. We have a werewolf smackdown here. Our first film is 1974's The Beast Must Die. It's an Amicus production, Amicus being a contemporary of Hammer Films. They made some great movies and had a lot of crossover actors with Hammer. And then opposite it, we have 1989's My Mom's a Werewolf, a lycanthropian fun romp through the 80s, transitioning into the 90s. We will talk a lot about that, I'm sure. With me, as usual, is Jeffrey Tucker. How you doing?
What's up? My face is Wolverine chic.
Yeah, you got you're more beard than man. And then we have, as always, Tad Mastroianni, a friend film buff. How are you doing, Tad?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Yep. Tad broke protocol to get a haircut because he's a terrible person.
Hey, you know, it always grows back.
It's okay. Miss Rona breaks for no one. All right. So first up, The Beast Must Die. This movie is one of those movies that it's a werewolf movie. You walk in, everyone in the drive-in, the theater, the first thing they're hit with is a narrator saying, this is not a horror movie, essentially. It's like, this is a mystery movie, right? It's literally a narrator, and he only shows up at two points. One, to say, this is a mystery, and later on in the film, for like 30 seconds to say, do you know who the werewolf is? Here's 30 seconds to decide, and it flashes people across the screen. Let us listen to the first snippet of this narrator.
The question is not who is the murderer, but who is the werewolf? After all the clues have been shown, you will get a chance to give your answer.
Okay, so he's got a great voice. It sets it up. It's a very British production. It's a very 70s production. As I said, it's an Amicus movie. They shared a lot of actors with Hammer Films and sort of competed with them a little bit. As you can see, Peter Cushing is in this movie as the werewolf specialist. Before we get into the plot of this movie, I just want to say, I think that the whole setup of it's a mystery, we'll give you a chance to guess, is interesting and it fits more in like a BBC television production. But it also is weird because they don't recap the clues or anything when they reveal the werewolf. And you're just, so I really don't think there is any way to actually know who the werewolf really is.
The clues are weak. I mean, I can run you through them all, but it's weak.
It could have
been many different people.
Exactly. It's like it could have been. And so they kept it. And there's some red herrings and things. All of them are fairly plausible. I don't really fault the film for this, but it is funny because they set it up as though you're supposed to know. Like, if you're good sleuth, you'll know. And you're like, no. No one in the movie knew. No one in the movie knew because no one could possibly know for sure. Yeah. So that is interesting. The plot is sort of a House on Haunted Hill setup, right? Instead of Vincent Price saying, everyone come stay at this haunted house to see if ghosts are real. It's instead this sort of, I think he's dashing, but this black man who is apparently very wealthy from business and also a master trophy hunter, Tom Newcliffe. He's played by Calvin Lockhart, who's a very strong actor. He's been in a lot of fantastic stuff. I am a fan. He's sort of a prototype Idris Elba. He's got the voice that gets really gravelly, and he has kind of a cold stare. And he's invited a group of people, unsuspecting people, to spend the 3 days of the full moon with him because he knows one of them is a werewolf, and he has reasons for believing that about everyone. And there's some interesting backstories that I kind of wish they went into a little more for everyone. Jeff, you suggested earlier that you thought he was a strong lead character, but he's not likable.
Yeah, I mean, he's a big game hunter, you know, which doesn't really get me excited.
I don't really care. In today's climate, that's not very good.
Yeah, and you know, an animal just for the achievement of it. You know, I don't really care for kidnappers. You know, he's essentially, that's essentially kidnapped a bunch of people.
Right, they want to leave, and he's like, nope, chases them down.
And I mean, he was a very compelling, very passionate. Like, he had a lot of passion. He had a lot of drive, and so he was compelling in that sense. But he was not very likable. Kind of any sense of the word. So it was kind of an interesting lead character to kind of like drive the plot along. I thought that he kind of overshadowed the other characters. Like, we really spent a lot of time with this character. Yep. Probably too much.
He's also, I mean, it sort of matches his personality in a way, right? He's very domineering. Like, it is his way or no way. Yeah. At all. Tad, what was your take on him?
At some point, especially as he starts to unhinge throughout the entire movie, I'm just like, did a werewolf fuck this guy's mom?
Right. Like, he has a huge hard-on for hating werewolves. And the thing is, he doesn't even seem he wants to hate him. He just, like Jeff said, he wants to kill it. Like, it's this very much, like, he calls it the most dangerous game. And as Tad, you mentioned before recording that this is sort of a take on the most dangerous game in some ways, because he's hunting someone and it's kind of a person. But it's not, I don't know that I would consider, like, the jump to werewolf to being the most dangerous game. Like, he obviously has some reason to believe that they're real, despite no one else having seen one except for potentially the werewolf themselves. And I guess it's a weird thing they tried to pull, because for maybe a little less than half the movie, maybe the first third or quarter of the movie, you don't know that there's really a werewolf. But then it is very clear that there is a werewolf, which in this case, it's not an anthropomorphic person. It's a person who literally transforms into a wolf and runs around and seems to have some intelligence behind it. So, and has to eat human flesh. Like, they try and take the pseudoscientific approach, right? Like, Peter Cushing plays the scientist, and he sort of gives them an interesting little diatribe that is obviously not scientific, but I would hazard to say that there's two types, right? There's the kind of like hard sci-fi thing where they give you like a plausible explanation. And then there's the one where it's completely insane, like Sharknado. There's a tornado and sharks, and they hurl them around, and sharks apparently enjoy this before landing to their death. Or there's this middle ground where they're like, we're going to give you just enough information where it sounds pseudoscientific. Maybe they give a little too much because you're like, okay, this is a little too detailed, and I can tell you right now that's not true. But it's pretty close. Let's listen to this clip. This is exactly what Peter Cushing is doing. They're having dinner. Everyone's getting grossed out as they're having, like, you know, rare roast, and the butler keeps pouring this deep red gravy over everyone's plate.
Well, I'm afraid there's worse to come. The werewolf will eventually die of its condition. Die one of the most painful and pitiful deaths imaginable. In the early stages of the disease, the blood recovers, and the werewolf can regain human shape almost at will. But at last, the blood becomes more and more unstable. The white corpuscles can no longer combat any disease, any virus known to mankind. This is what kills the werewolf.
So essentially, werewolf's weakness is COVID when they get old, right? Like any virus, anything like that, they can't handle it once they get older.
So it's HIV.
Yeah, exactly. It's an autoimmune deficiency disease. And it's an interesting thing. I like that the doctor is like, he has a line right before this. He's like, make no mistake, the werewolf is a victim, right? Like they can't help their cravings. They turn into a wolf. They have to eat human flesh. It lets them turn back into a person essentially. And as the disease progresses, they get more control over their transformations, but they also are inching more towards death. Right. So you don't know is what stage of life is this werewolf at that is supposedly in this group. I thought that was an interesting twist. I think they could have played more with it. My personal take is that there was a lot of tension. There was decent tension. It definitely is a mystery film. It is not a horror film, I don't think. I think that horror buffs could be interested in it because it does have a werewolf angle. And there is some tension and hunting and you don't know, but it's definitely a solid, they weren't lying. It's a mystery movie. It's a whodunit.
And I mean, like even that clip that you just played, it was essentially a clue that it wasn't Peter Cushing's character, right? Because he was an elderly man, older than all the other characters. So he was kind of like, you know, excluding himself from the pool of people that could be the werewolf. I actually, you know, it's kind of tough when you give like the exposition for explaining the, you know, the disease or whatever to a person that could possibly be a carrier based on the, you know, premise, which again is kind of ridiculous. Like, how does he know which one of that one of these people is a werewolf? He's just, he would either know one of them is a werewolf or like he could know that all of them could be werewolves, but like, how does he know that exactly one of the people in his party? That premise is very ridiculous.
And that's why the whole time you're thinking like, what if they're all werewolves, right? Because he has reasons, right? Like one character played by Paul Foote, who's great. He went to jail briefly. He's a painter who went to jail briefly when he was in med school because he and like eight other people, I think, tried human flesh from a study cadaver. And so he went to jail for cannibalism and he's like, did you do it because it was fascinating or did you do it because you couldn't help yourself? And everybody else is sort of thing where, you know, everywhere they go, a couple of people die here and there. Now, spoiler alert, I think this movie, just a heads up, I think this movie is watchable regardless of whether or not you know. I think with the names, by the time you go watch the movie, if you haven't seen it already, which I think is very likely, then you will have forgotten everything I tell you and who's who. But I think that when Calvin Lockhart's character early in the movie goes through each of their histories and why they're there, I think he has a pretty strong opinion of why the guy that turns out to actually be the initial werewolf, I think that's a pretty clear one, right? Like he can't go to foreign places because people show up dead and eaten everywhere he goes. Like, is that not the most obvious? Everyone else is like, one time you went to Zurich and someone, you know, died and was partially eaten or someone disappeared. And then, by the way, everywhere you go, people are eaten and you've been banned from several capitals because of it. That's a pretty...
Well, additionally to that, that character, like the very early, he creates like, you know, the minivan chase scene.
Yeah.
You know, the world's slowest chase scene where the main lead essentially just takes like a bunch of shortcuts and eventually gets ahead. It was hilarious because every time you get to see like a split in the road, it's like, oh yeah, he's going to take that one and he's going to eventually get ahead of him. But it was, but anyways, at the end of it, he gets out of the car and this guy's like, says something to the effect of, you know, let everybody else go and like, I'll stay.
Yeah.
Which I thought was like a big red herring for me. Like, it was like, such an obvious thing for somebody who can't control themselves and eat people. Like,
well, for sure.
Thing to say. But, like, it was so early. It was, like, the first, it was, like, one of the first pieces of, like, actual dialogue in the movie.
Right. Yeah. And I think that actor, I believe, is Anton Differing. It's hard to tell because I am familiar with Anton Differing's work, but he's got these huge chops and a big...
Oh, no, that one's Michael Gambon. That's Dumbledore.
That was Dumbledore?
I'm pretty sure that's Dumbledore.
The actual werewolf, the original actual werewolf?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally Dumbledore.
Yeah,
Dumbledore. Second Dumbledore, not first Dumbledore.
Right, correct. Yeah. I was thinking it was, he was the control room operator, but that must be then.
Yeah, he's unrecognizable. Like, I mean, his voice is there. Like, if you listen to his voice.
Yeah, oh, Yeah, then that's a very so strange. Young. You're right. Anton Diffing, that's why I was having trouble seeing him in it, is he plays the initial guy, the first casualty who runs Lockhart's, the Hunter's, like, Batman system to track everything. That's interesting. So the movie's actual opening is, while I will say it's a little overlong, it's interesting. And I think this movie is pretty good at giving you bits and pieces with, they trust you to be a smart audience. For example, the film opens with Calvin Lockhart's character being chased, a black man being chased through the woods by a bunch of white guys with guns, while Anton Diffring's character gives them directions and orders through like a headquarters where he can track where he is. And I have to tell you, as we're recording this right now, we're having, there are widespread protests in support of Black Lives Matter and in regards to George Floyd's murder. And it's a very tense, in my opinion, necessary turn of events to make these things known. But it was very weird to turn on the movie and instantly be confronted with a black man literally being hunted. Very strange. And it's sort of, and I think the movie is aware of that, even being 1974, certainly race relations were still a big issue then. They're aware of that because you get that, and then he stumbles out of the woods, and like four or so of the soldiers show up behind him, and all the other characters are having like a lunch party on the lawn of the estate. And as he stands there sweaty with torn clothes, the other guy, he waves them off like, forget these soldiers. And then they appear to shoot him and he falls down. And it's a big spoof, right? Like he's having a play with the guests who are horrified and he's being shot with blanks. And what he was doing was testing the system that this guy installed. So the whole him being chased through the woods set you up as a viewer to sort of play on your inherent stereotype that this guy is clearly down on his luck and he's being victimized, when in reality, he's actually the strongest character in the film and has the most resources. And I thought that was a very interesting way of, right off the bat, the movie, without being loud about it, subverts your expectation.
Yeah, I agree. That was like the first thing that kind of tinged me. It was like, because I had figured it out pretty early, like once I was seeing like the microphones and stuff. I'm like, all right, this is, and like the guy that got called off the first time, it was like, it became pretty obvious, like to me, being like a person who watches everything, that there was like a system being tested here.
Exactly. Well, like as you go through, he starts spotting the cameras in the trees, the microphones they have placed in the ground. And like you said, he's caught one point at gunpoint by one of the guys, and the Anton Diffring in the control room says, basically, you let him go, you'll get another chance. And he runs on. And that was the whole movie sort of does that pretty steadily. I think that the way they disseminate information, like that chase scene you were talking about that was overlong, which certainly is overlong. I don't know what about the 70s made people think that we would love to watch 20 mile an hour car chases. That was the true pandemic of the 70s, was running through that in every film. But in the script, you can tell it wasn't without purpose, because the whole purpose was, he probably constructed this road to the village from his estate, and clearly it is not a straight shot. It is a winding shot, so he knows where every single turnoff is and has these little side paths to cut off anyone, and he's playing with him, right? He's like, caught up with you here, caught up with you here, until he eventually cuts him off.
Well, like also like the alternate paths were kind of rough, so it was like his altering vehicle it's like a Jeep.
As opposed to like a pickup or something like that, it's not even a pickup, it's a car.
It was some sedan type thing.
It's certainly like he didn't have to say. I feel like even contemporary films, so often he would have got out and be like, "How did you beat me?" And he'd be like, "I've got my own paths, Mr. Blah blah blah." You don't need it. And I will say though, because we're used to it, it's shocking to actually have to use your brain, you watch it. Yeah. And Tad, I don't know if you noticed that whole, it's just a different vibe.
It is, yeah. And that's that. You and I have both watched a lot of old movies, and I miss not being treated like a moron when I'm watching a movie or having everything spoon-fed. And there's very few movies in the past 10, 20 years that still do that. I mean, and the ones that do are some of my favorite films of all time. But I realized pretty quickly I didn't need this character to be likable. I needed him to have depth, and he had plenty of it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it because there was depth to a character for once.
It's interesting because we do get a little bit of his backstory, right? Early on when he's talking to his, you know, his HQ headman who's monitoring the TVs and all and the maps and everything. And he's like, I came up, you know, everyone else from my village, they're still there. You know, there's nothing. And then I succeeded because I am a hunter. I was always a hunter, and I was a hunter in the boardroom, and I'm a hunter in the wild, right? So you get just enough, I personally, for me to think, okay, I know his character. I may not know if he'll have an arc, but he has, and I think he does have a bit of an arc. But I know that he is doing this probably because this is what he has to do, right? Like, what else is left for him? That's kind of his whole thing, right? Like, I'm going to hunt the most dangerous because I've done everything and succeeded. What happens if I stand still? Not going to face that. I'm going to go to the next thing, which most people would think is pure insanity, right? As most of the characters think, he is super crazy.
He's got to prove he's still the alpha predator.
Right. Even at the expense of his wife. Right. His wife is she's a beautiful actress, very talented, Marlene Clark. Horror fans will probably know her from Gone Jin Hess, a 70s zombie flick. She has these great, like, Nichelle Nichols from Uhura kind of like scene chewing moments where it's just enough melodrama, and they love to get in close on her face as she sort of tears into her husband for, you know, keeping these people here, ruining the mood, all this stuff, you know, saying you love it more than me kind of thing. And he proves her right. Yes, he does. And I think that their dichotomy, it's not super deeply explored. It's really a side moment, but it gives enough to feel like there is, like, I guess I didn't feel like they don't love each other in this, whereas in like a core component of a similar film, House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price, is that he and his wife, current wife, hate each other, right? And that's this tension between the whole party. Like, he's having it, but he's having it his way, and she wanted it, but she wanted it this way. In this, that's not the case. The case is that she loves him, presumably, and it seems to be that way, and he has some sort of love for her as much as he can while not sacrificing his goal. And it's... that adds a different tension because just like everyone else, she's a potential victim now because they're all locked with a murderous monster. And I think that the cast adds to that tension without requiring a whole lot of information from the script, right? Because I think the acting carries a lot of what is sometimes a scant script.
Oh, it was great. I love, because he states it right out to her. It's like, you loved the ride. And she's like, not anymore. And that was, he almost had a growling Wesley Snipes-ish kind of feel to that at that moment right there.
Yep. Yeah. And he does, that's the thing. He does that Idris Elba sneer kind of like dark, gravelly thing. The more the film gets on and the more he's becoming aggressive to the other people there. My favorite character is actually Todd Chadbon's character, who I think is Paul Foote, I think is his character's name. He's sort of the free-spirited, tongue-in-cheek painter who ate, you know, human flesh and went to jail for it at one point in time. He's still acting. He's a voice actor as well. He was in he played Denarius in Dragon Age 2. If any gamers are listening here, he's great. I really enjoyed him. He sort of messes with the lead as he goes on, sort of taunting him, and he seems like a very plausible case to be the werewolf. But he also has these moments where he shows fear, right? Like, he's like, I do want to get out of here. Like, this is not fun anymore. without losing sort of his humor. And I think that's why he's one of the cast members to last the longest, is because he really is sort of the most intriguing. Like, who wouldn't want to listen to a guy who went to jail for eating someone and now paints by whipping a canvas with a homemade whip? Like, that's bizarre. And we get that information, and then let's move on to the ex-pianist. And you're like, well, let's go back. Let's go back to that guy.
This is a motherfucker who has no problem digging through this guy's house, digging out a bow and arrow, shooting purposely to miss him, and then goes, oh, I missed ya. It's like, oh, this guy is...
Did he miss him intentionally, though? I don't know.
We don't know. And that's the thing. Yeah. We don't know. And I mean, because, I mean, I don't know. Like, why... I wouldn't trust.
Maybe that was his out, you know?
So. Like knowing that both of you haven't shot a bow extensively, I would not trust either of you to joke around with me. You
know? And, you're making assumptions,
go
sir.
Right there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's.
So you're saying you were not going to put an apple on your head next time I see you?
No.
And I'm taking out a bow and arrow. That's no not going to happen.
That's like, I'm going to tell
0%
you.
0% chance.
Straight okay. up, that is not going to happen. Just save it. Save your money. Save your money. Yeah, so I he's my favorite character. And there's lots of something else that I thought was interesting. And this is based off a story. I don't know if it's a book or a short story. But it's, you can kind of tell because it's a little bit more literary minded. It's more about the details than it is about the action or anything like that. As we mentioned, the werewolf in this is not a costumed werewolf. He is a dog, essentially, a man who turns into a wolf. And
a very handsome dog. It's a
beautiful dog. Big, beautiful yeah. dog. I don't know if they use multiples, but he's a beautiful dog. I don't know what kind he is. He looks sort of like a shaved Chow Malamute.
Yeah, I don't
gray.
Think it was a single like,
I don't think
species,
so either. But it was always a nice thing. And they did a good yeah. job of not showing, like, you know, early on it's a wolf of some or a wolf like dog. They show him, but they never like give you like a scene that breaks the tension between he's like a beast. Like they never show him like loping in a silly way where it's like, ugh, we just saw he's a dog, right? Like, no, we see him looming through the skylight at one point, oh. right? We see him leaping in the air towards someone's face. You know, these things are pretty well done. And I like seeing a film that's like, no, we're not going to do this. And I'm sure it was cost prohibitive too, right? We're not going to do this over the top of, you know, special effects because it's not the focal point of the story. Mm-hmm. One thing that struck me is, and I'm sure no animals were harmed in the filming of this movie. It's a fairly lightweight thing. And it is the 70s in England. So they did tend to be more conscious of animal rights, not as much as now. But I did think it was interesting. Most footage you see of dogs being aggressive is now CGI or even old footage, because most dogs for film stuff are trained not to be aggressive. So it's sort of funny. They'll dub over like a growl or whatever while they have a dog like throw the ball. And there's one scene when the hunter's personal dog is fighting the wolf, right? And those two dogs, like, would they kill each other? Being I would say an experienced dog owner, probably not. But they are not happy. It is definitely an aggressive, there's clearly two people holding leashes on either side of these animals while they're growling and biting and snarling at each other, some of which is dubbed in, but it definitely is aggressive behavior. And I'm like, I don't think we would see that now because I think people would be upset. And like I said, I don't think anyone who's upset by animal cruelty of any kind, myself, I'm one of those, should not see this film. I don't think that it's dramatic or dire, and I don't think anything was put in danger, but it is something that we're a lot more conscious of that you won't see now. And there's no CGI. This is 1974. So you get what you see is what actually is there. I don't know if anyone else was struck by that. There's also that particular scene, a lot of shit's going on, right? Like the helicopter's blowing up, it's flaming. You can actually, the lighting seemed to be pretty good in that because you get a lot of the warm flickering light, which is impressive because most of the evening scenes are horrible blue filter day for night shots where you see glaring daylight reflecting on things with a slight blue tint. I don't know if anyone else noticed
that. Oh yeah,
that.
But you know why that is, right?
Oh, it's expensive to light. It's all
natural. Oh no. There's a reason why they had to do night scenes during the day.
Oh, what is that?
Because back in the day, and it was a controversial topic even back then, because the lead was a black man, It caused issues with filming at night, so they had to actually filter and do it during the day so it wouldn't wash them out, basically. Which it's like, no, that's actually a real thing that film had a problem with back then.
That's interesting, because I would, and of course, especially in the 70s, you get this like fantastic color saturation in the film, but it is problematic because it does wash things out. And it's a big step up from, you know, the very early color films, but at the same time, it muddies the picture. And I would hazard to say that it's probably a failed choice, because the picture is pretty muddy a lot of the times with that awful blue filter.
I'm pretty sure back then they were just like, well, this is the cheapest and easiest solution. Let's go with it.
And it just, as a note, Paul Annette, who was responsible for directing this film, fought with the producer about that werewolf break where you guess who the werewolf is. He thought it was stupid, and it wasn't part of the original film. And Milton Sabotsky, who is a producer at the time, said, nope, you have to have that. That's what's going to draw the people. I don't know if it worked. I would love to know their take on that, because
yeah, we need to find someone to watch this movie back in the day in the theater and be like, hey, what did you think of this thing?
Yeah. I don't really.
So for me, I felt like both of these films fit more like in an anthology series. It almost like that break almost made me think like, I don't know, whoever was working on this thought to, you know, they were making like a Twilight Zone episode almost, mm-hmm. like with kind of that initial fourth wall breaking. And then, you know, and then at the end, it comes back again. You know, where that kind of like leaves the audience. But yeah, like you said earlier, this movie really doesn't lead the audience that much. It really requires you to be paying attention and thinking and being thoughtful. So it's almost weird that they're like, hey, stop.
Right.
There was a mystery happened. You should take a guess now. You know, it's kind of awkward.
It's done in a very 70s way. They're literally, they stop, they show you the freeze frame of like a wolf's face in blue, and then, and they print the letters across the screen. And then they show you an animated clock face in the center playing over small clips of each character who could be the werewolf as it goes through. And like we said, there's really no way to know for sure who the werewolf or werewolves are at that point. So it's sort of I can see why the director is like, don't do this. And they're like, you have to do this. I don't know. It does seem like a production for film. It seems, I'm going to try this one more time, like a production for television as opposed to a production for the big screen. I think because of that, because it does some things that, I mean, that takes you out of the moment a little bit.
It could have been a stage play like Sheer Madness, where whoever the audience guesses, it's the werewolf the entire time, no matter who you guess.
And I would love to see that. And I think there's a lot of monologuing in this movie, but because the cast is so well, I welcome that. You know, hearing Peter Cushing talk, you know, he does a little bit of an accent that's not English. I don't know if he's supposed to be German or not. I don't think that he does a poor job at it. He certainly has done it before. So I think he's worth watching. And I think that, you know, Tom Chadbon, Michael, what's his name? Gambon and Calvin Lockhart, they're all carry the scenes pretty strongly. So when they get these chunks of text, it's worth it.
Oh yeah. The acting is great in this film, for sure. Like across the board, maybe like outside of the woman who plays Michael Gambon's wife,
his girlfriend. She doesn't get much of a role.
She really has like kind of like a screaming role, which was probably pretty common at the time. But
yeah, I would think so.
She doesn't seem to have a point of view. She doesn't seem to. Mm-mm. Really have any character.
Well, and so it's weird, speak. Right? It's weird because, and that's, and I could be saying her name wrong, but Kiaran Madden, she's, as everyone in this, she's been in a lot of British productions. And I don't know what her reason was, especially when we have, for example, a strong female character in Calvin Lockhart's wife. I mean, one, how could he have anything but a strong female character? I can't imagine that anyone would tolerate him that didn't have a strong point of view. Well,
I think she was just there so that they're like that opening line from Michael Gambon where he said, let everybody else go, keep me.
Yeah,
you're right. It creates like a plausible other answer for him saying that.
Yeah, true.
Though a very fucking weak one.
Yeah, yeah, like it is very a weak one. And I think that that's, I guess, the takeaway on this film is that it's a mystery where you're intrigued and it kept me on the thing, but there was no way for me to solve the mystery. Like at best, I would be like, oh, I'm kind of right, you know? And it's mostly just, you're like, who couldn't possibly be a werewolf at this point? You know, that's the only thing. And I do think that there's a little bit of a twist in there after the werewolf break, or you guess.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, the tension level is there in this film, but it's not a like, you know, like edge of your seat gripping. It is more of like a cozy mystery almost.
Yeah.
You know, and so I enjoyed watching that, but I think if you were to call it a thriller, you would be missing the boat. I think it's a solid mystery.
So I'm wondering who you guys thought it was, because I actually thought, and I'll give you my reasoning, I thought it was, even though I had, you know, some ideas for other options, I thought it was Peter Cushing's character, because he was basically giving all of the exposition as to what a werewolf was, which seemed like to me like he was an unreliable like author for those things. It's like, oh, it couldn't be an old person. Couldn't be a person that's holding silver.
It couldn't be me.
Right. You know?
I had that feeling throughout the entire time. I'm like, is Peter Cushing's character just bullshitting the entire time? And he doesn't actually know what werewolves do, because remember, he tells them one thing and he's like, oh, by the way.
Right. Yeah. Like, by the way, holding silver wouldn't have been an issue because there was no wolfsbane in the air, you know, like, and then later there's wolfsbane in the air. Like, and by the way, kudos to them for calling back all, for the original story writer and the movie, for calling back all these really old school werewolf snippets of facts. But I think that there was definitely strong red herrings for him. I think that it would have been, if it was a criminal, like, if it was a law case, you would probably have the strongest case that it was Peter Cushing's character, because especially after the werewolf break, he has Calvin Lockhart's character, the hunter, has everyone hold a silver bullet. And then Peter Cushing is like, before he even gets the bullet, he's like, of course, someone could cover their hands with today's technology with a silicon or some sort of, you know, invisible thing, and no one would know. And then, of course, Calvin Lockhart's like, fine, everyone has to put it in their mouth because you wouldn't coat your mouth. And then he's like, okay. And then everyone does it. And then it gets to, of course, it's the same bullet, which is super gross. They pop it in, pop it out, give it to the next person. And then Peter Cushing's character gets it and he's all grouchy about it. And he takes out a hanky and wipes it clean. And I'm like, okay, it could have been a switcheroo. Like, you know, even
or
though
he just coated it, right?
Right. And then he puts it in his mouth and then he wipes it off again and hands it off. You know, so that was definitely one of those moments where not only does he have the most information, but he's telling you how you could be a werewolf and get away with it, and it's still not him.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly where I was. It felt like too good almost. Like after all, that was like such a good reveal. He was like, ha ha ha, I've been messing with you all this time. I'm really the werewolf and now you're all dead.
Mm-hmm. You know? And the other thing, and that brings me to this thought, is how many, is like, there were a couple of things in this movie that, even if maybe they weren't used for the first time, you can see them used again to even greater effect in future films. Because like the whole setup with how they're tracking the werewolf in the woods in like the first night it's out, and the headquarters guy is giving Calvin Lockhart's character directions, and he's like, he's getting closer. Like, I mean, that is used to a T in Aliens, in one of the most famous scenes from the franchise, right? When the alien is in the ventilation ducts and they're like, boop, 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 he's right above you. Like that whole thing. Like we see that again. And that is to a T the setup at the beginning of this movie. Another one is when they're all putting the bullet in their mouth, right? Or when they're touching silver, it's a lot like
the scene in The Thing, even more so John Carpenter's remake, because the original Thing, of course, predates this film. It's from the 50s. But you've got the whole, like, everyone in the room do this because it will reveal, and everyone has to do the thing. It's like the blood test in The Thing. And they're good tension devices, and they're really good tension devices. And that's why we see them come up again and again. And I thought it was interesting that we had two examples of probably the best cinematic horror tension devices in this film, albeit, you know, it's not a horror film per se.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone else noticed that or any other scenes that they were like, ooh, this is a good tension scene.
It's my favorite one, especially because it gives his wife another chance to be sassy. Is it time to take my pill? Mm-hmm.
Right, when he hands her the silver bullet.
It's like her character was there to give him the most shit when everyone else was freaked out of their mind. Right. And
she's
loved
the only
it.
One. Yeah, she's the only one that will talk back
I'm
to him.
I'm tired of your bullshit.
Yeah. And I thought that, and there's that twist with her, which I thought it worked. Of course, again, then you have the scientist, Peter Cushing, to explain how it happened. And it makes him even more suspect. Every time he has the most information, you're like,
yeah.
I
also thought like that one didn't fly that well. Cause like we all saw a scene with him and her standing next to each other, looking at the wolf. So it was
we knew it
was so obvious. Yeah. Like when she started turning, it was like, okay, well, there's clearly somebody else.
There's more than one. Right.
Yeah.
And that was, like you said, the problem with the premise, where in the theater, things like this happen all the time, right? In the theater, you suspend your disbelief because you're watching new information and you're taking in new information the whole time. Mm-hmm. And if a movie lets you sit too long, you start poking holes in it. Like, wait for my rant, okay? In The Predator, Shane Black's recent Predator film, which I absolutely despise, I will tell you why right now, the film makes no sense. Absolutely zero sense. The logic is taken. It's like a plate that's decorating the wall. He takes it off, he smashes it, and then he steps all over it, and then he throws it in a wood chipper. It is the worst, most blatant obliteration of cinematic storytelling logic ever. Because the entire plot, spoiler, there's no spoiler, it's not a smart plot, is one kind of predator lands on the earth to bring a suit that turns a person essentially into a robo predator to kill other predators. Okay, fine, whatever. It's super stupid, but we're going to move on beyond that, because how does this good predator show up to earth to deliver this weapon of salvation against the predator onslaught, which is not coming, we don't think at all. He does it by showing up and then killing a whole bunch of people. So his plan to save the human race is to deliver a weapon to fight his own kind, but he's gonna kill a lot of people first for no particular reason. And then we're gonna watch this, and then at the end get the superhero transformation moment that sets up a sequel that nobody wants to see. At least I don't wanna see it. I'm like, Shane Black, you stopped making Iron Man. Iron Man 3 was the last one you did, buddy. You don't need a big mechanical suit at the end of every single one of your movies. It doesn't work that way.
Nate, I have a question.
Yes.
Why did you go see a Predator remake?
It's not a remake.
It's not a remake. It's a soft reboot.
It's not even, it's just a continuation.
Oh, a soft reboot. Those always turn out real well. Especially
you sold me. I've got to see this film.
It got good reviews because it's basically a funny buddy. It's a funny buddy movie. Olivia Munn, and is like, but none of the characters are likable. It makes no sense. It's essentially a Suicide Squad where you have a couple of funny jokes and a terrible. Here's the thing. I don't hate Suicide Squad. Okay. I think Warner Brothers screwed up with a lot of reshoots. We're getting way off topic into the weeds
here. We have our first tangent on Colton Classics.
But what I'm saying is that it is a bad movie. The plot made no sense. And apparently no one decided to actually call anyone on how insanely stupid the nonsensical gibberish was. Like, I don't understand why the idea of an alien big game hunter, which would have worked with this, see, I'm bringing it back, theme, big game hunter, okay? I don't understand why the idea of an alien big game hunter coming to Earth and killing the biggest and strongest to get trophies is somehow
a dull idea that needs to be reimagined as a team superhero movie. I don't understand that. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make literary sense. It makes no sense. No sense.
Some analytics probably told him this is what they need.
All I can see is DMT singing along to every background track of Shane Black, of Shane Black's The Predator.
That would actually make it better.
Yeah, you know what, it would. It would have made it better.
Let me rewrite this. The Predators are now coming to Earth to find out performers to bring to the intergalactic arcane
system. this kid gets it.
Reboot called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2.5 back to the sewer in space.
The Colton Classic Extended Universe continues. Holy shit.
Okay.
Soundtrack, by the way. Soundtrack's amazing. You all know I'm very big on soundtrack. I love that old 70s vibe with movies.
It's sort of a soundtrack that oftentimes would fit better in like a caper movie from the 70s.
Bond in the intro and
exactly.
The extra
it's like an espionage kind of thing, and I like it. I'd listen to it. It's that whole lounge setup.
Well, I mean, Calvin was in a bunch of blaxploitation films, and it started off almost as if it was like a blaxploitation cop movie. So I was kind of like, oh, what is going on here?
Yeah, and I mean, both he and Marlene Clark started there and kind of got their chops there. So I think that's the way to go. All right, we're gonna wrap up this segment on The Beast Must Die with our regular recommendations. So I'm going to go first this time. I would recommend this movie to people who like werewolves, strong performances, and are not turned off by a not fast-paced plot. It's very British, and it's very TV cozy mysteries. But especially if you have loved ones who don't want to watch a horror flick, but they like watching Midsummer Murders or something on BBC, give this film a go. Jeff, what do you think?
Oh, I think this is just for like anthology lovers. Like you guys know, like anthology series are like just my absolute jam.
He's a Black Mirror fan.
It requires essentially a different way for plotting. Like you just need characters and you just need something compelling. Like that's it. That's all you need for an anthology series. And I thought that's where this played in. Like I actually think it should have been part of an anthology series. As a film, it would have fit in with, some sort of theme that was like maybe like horror-esque or just mystery. Or even maybe it probably could have even been in like a science fiction, like
it feels like a short story instead of a novel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think people who just love film and like love that kind of like anthology feel would love this film.
All right, Tad, you're up. What do you think? Who would you recommend this film to?
I'd recommend it to people who enjoy that old 70s Hammer kind of feel, and also people who want to watch Clue with 100% more dog.
That is
I didn't get in there with the clue joke.
The clue. That is excellent.
Beat you excellent. To it.
Damn.
Oh, all right. All right. We're gonna move on to our next one.
Be moving on.
All right. Next up is our second feature for this episode, 1989's My Mom's a Werewolf. Now, if you're thinking that this looks like a comical teen monster movie romp, that's certainly what they were aiming for. That's what they were aiming for. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they hit it 100% on the head, we're going to talk about that. The plot, pretty basic. A dull, sort of ignored housewife whose husband doesn't pay any attention to her and just watches football on the weekends and whatever and eats out before coming home. She runs into a pet store owner who happens to be a werewolf. And he uses his hypnosis eyes to try and have an affair with her and ends up biting her. And it's sort of a vampiric kind of setup. He tries to continue to coerce her into becoming his werewolf bride to continue his species. Fighting against him is her daughter, who is present, I guess, in the movie. I'm not sure we get a huge amount of personality.
She exists.
From.
Holy shit. You've shit-talked this movie in, like, less than a minute.
Oh, you know what? No, I'm going to be honest. I actually enjoy this movie. I do. I think that there's a lot of fun things in this movie. Just to kind of to throw it out there, it's directed by Michael Fischer, who he's still making movies. He's got a new movie coming out presumably next year. But he's done some anthology horror films. He did Death Spa in 1989 as well, which is actually, I love that movie. Maybe we'll talk about it one day on the podcast. My Mom's a Werewolf was his first feature directorial debut film. So I think for a first feature in the 80s, I give it props. I think that it's not completely incompetent in the directing. It looks like something, like I said earlier, this seems like it should be on TNT every October. Mm. It's just one of those movies where you, like the computer wore tennis shoes, you'd click in and you know, be like, oh, what is this? And keep watching it. So here's the thing. The poster features sort of an 80s montage of like the daughter and the husband walking to the bathroom while we see these woman's legs that are super hairy while she's shaving. What was your vibe for the film going in? Was it accurate to what it ended up being?
To me, I mean, this was exactly what I would have expected. I mean, it's silly. I should hate it, but somehow I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's, I think the points that like got me laughing the hardest were clearly not intentional. you know, like I think my favorite part of the film is when this like purse snatcher runs through like a car wash and like kind of knocks over like one guy, and like the guy that's working with him like grabs him and like holds him, and then like they do this thing where, you know, he's gonna like punch the dude in his face, but he ducks and he punches, you know, his buddy in the face, but it looks so ridiculous. It is so poorly choreographed, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And I busted out laughing. I just couldn't. It was like, you know, it was kind of like your like Melissa McCarthy like trying to do her like best like physical comedy, but it was so unintentional.
We here at Cult and Classic Podcast support vaccines. So I think you're right. There is some unintentional comedy. I think first off, the biggest obstacle that My Mom's a Werewolf has to being a good movie is, you know, despite the fact that I find it an enjoyable movie, is the pacing. There's some scenes where it's too long, especially with Susan Blakely plays Leslie, the mom, who is in the process of turning werewolf. She's, you'll probably recognize her. She was in The Towering Inferno. She was in Over the Top with Sylvester Stallone. This movie, even more so than The Beast Must Die, is one where every single person, you're like, where do I know them from? Because they're character actors who've been in a million things, but you may not know their name. And the pacing when Susan Blakely is on the screen by herself is a little rough. They expect a lot out of her to carry a script that doesn't have enough jokes and certainly doesn't have enough that land the way they meant them to. Mm. It's tough. So I think that's the biggest hurdle. But when you have these moments, there is physical comedy. There are some jokes, whether or not you feel like they landed or not. There are definitely jokes. And I think it's solidly a comedy. Whether or not you thought it was successful as a comedy, it's definitely a comedy. You're never questioning whether it's a comedy. Like you said, it's exactly what you expect it to be. This is the lost 80s dumb comedy about a werewolf.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not like kind of the modern like horror comedy. It tends to be like kind of more serious with with like a lot of jokes late, like, you know, you look like kind of Shaun of the Dead.
Yep, exactly.
You know, it's like a really like serious like zombie film, but then like the characters are just, they're in a comedy, you know. It's just there's like kind of that weird contrast in this. Everything is just like very clearly and kind of like a silly, almost like kind of more like our modern parody film.
Well, like, and even it's more like that sort of quote unquote lost art of the 90s family film. Like you still get them every once in a while, kind of hitting like Disney Channel or something, where you get like Aliens in the Attic, you know, that sort of thing, or Small Soldiers, although that one gets a little dark too. So it's like, but that kind of, it's not Gremlins, you know, there's no body count, but it's not the super kid friendly thing that would play on Nick Jr. You know, there's a lot of sex jokes in it. They don't land on the, this is, okay, we're going to play this one. This is my favorite line. Now, we haven't even gotten to the fact that John Saxon plays Harry LaThrope, who is the pet store owner. We assume he's the pet store owner. He lives there, I guess. So I assume it's his. But he's the werewolf. And he is awesome, full disclosure. I've met his son on many occasions. He's a nice guy. And no one, to my knowledge, in the film industry or otherwise, has anything bad to say about John Saxon. He was a teen idol. He was one of the only people to get fan mail when he started out as an extra and didn't even have a named part. Women were sending him fan mail to the studios. So he's had a long, great career, and he's been in a million movies. And I can only assume he took this role because it was his only chance to play a werewolf. I'm going to assume, cause he is, you know, this isn't even shade to anyone else on the production. He's outclassing everyone with his acting. In my opinion, he holds every scene. He does his little like glasses drop, like seduction look, very well. But this is him talking to the mom character, Leslie.
You radiate love and compassion. I just want to crawl up inside of you and die.
There's a pleasant thought.
So this is, to me, the most, like, all, like 100% the style of comedy in this movie. It almost makes sense. You can see where they started to go with it, and then it goes off the rails, and they don't bother to rein it back in. Like, and as this particular scene is playing out, that is a very dirty thing to say. He's trying to seduce this housewife, and he says, "I want to crawl up inside you," and then pauses and die. And you're like, there are so many things I need to process. and then her response, because to her credit, she plays it exactly the way it's probably written. Like Susan Blakely, she really nails this dull, kind of ditzy, bored and boring mom really well. And she's like, "There's a pleasant thought," and her eyes are totally space cadet. And you just I don't even know where her head's at. I don't think she's registering anything that's happening around her. She's just kind of always in a daze. And this scene is like that. If you thought that was entertaining, you should watch this movie, because at its peak, the comic moments are going to be that sort of bizarre, non sequitur. Am I right in that?
It's quotable in a way that you'll quote it and no one will know what the fuck you're talking about.
And I will be quoting it. And it's a problem because I'll be quoting it and no one will know what I'm talking about. I'll have to explain. I'm jumping over some discussion here, but the writer of this, Mark Pirro, he's still making movies. And his movies have gotten even more odd, I guess I would say. For example, in 2003, he made Rectuma, which, let's go ahead. I'm just going to read you the summary that's currently on IMDb. Waldo Williams is infected by a Mexican butt-humping bullfrog, and soon his butt grows a mind of its own as well as 20 feet in size and terrorizes Los Angeles. Now Waldo must prove his innocence by proving that his rectum is responsible for the murders and not him.
So he wrote a South Park episode?
That film is 1 hour and 35 minutes long. I'm just throwing that out there.
Can we review this? Because it sounds better than Shark Exorcist.
and here's what I'm going to say. Rectuma got a 4.3 out of 10 aggregate score on IMDb, which isn't necessarily the be-all, end-all for reviews. And My Mom's a Werewolf got a 4.4. So
wow,
I'm just gonna say this right now. I don't believe that My Mom's a Werewolf deserves a 4.4. I would probably give it a 5 to a 5.5, depending on your desire for 80s, 90s comedies. Because this really, I mean, this is an 80s, 90s comedy. There's if you enjoy those things, you'll probably find something to enjoy without having to, you know, pretend that you're enjoying yourself, which I've had to do many times in my life.
I have a hard time rating these types of things because, I mean, I watched this film myself, but to me, it really, I think it goes better in a party, like in a group of people where you can watch and you can like be like, what the hell, like really, and like enjoy the kind of the silly moments in a group. So it's hard to rate these things because they're it's kind of dynamic based on the number of people watching it and how much alcohol they've had.
I think Shark Exorcist is certainly one of those. I would hazard to say that there are people who will enjoy My Mom's a Werewolf without that need, because I mean, it does have a plot. It does have some common horror comedy and comedy tropes that people like. So initially, we meet the Leslie and we meet her daughter, and then her daughter goes to a horror convention with her horror nerd friend who is next to John Saxon, the best actress in this, Diana Barrow. She's also, I mean, she's been in she's kind of a horror fixture at some convention. She was in Friday the 13th part 7. And she's done some of this. She's great. We actually reached out to her to see if we get in touch with her, but she's not available, which is unfortunate, but I've got a clip for you here, of her talking to, the daughter at this horror convention. Here we go.
Wow! Look at this! An original replica of Claude Rains' costume in The Invisible Man!
I have never met anyone who lives and breathes monsters the way you do.
That's all I live for. Monsters and Ralph.
Same thing.
Again, we get another kind of the humor level of this. It's like, I love monsters and Ralph. Same thing. We do meet Ralph later on, by the way, for like 2 seconds. And I mean, he's an attractive, good looking guy. He's very fit. I guess I don't know that he really deserved to be a named character in the film, but hey, what are you gonna do? But yeah, I think that the best friend character, the kooky friend, that Diana Barrows plays, her name is Stacey Puba. So we know the level of the script here. She's spot on. She carries every scene she's in, and she has, I think Jeff, you mentioned it, she has a huge amount of screen time, probably more than a lot of other characters and a lot of lines.
Yes, probably the most lines for sure.
She does the exposition, she does all that jazz. She is the one that encourages, in fact, forces Jennifer, who's the daughter, who's played by Tina Caspary, who, again, everyone in this movie has worked. There's no one that hasn't had a fairly decent career and worked the 80s and 90s shift. In fact, if any fans out there know Mac and Me, the 1988 E.T.-ish film, I'm going to put ish on that with a strong ish, she's in that movie in one of the lead roles. So she's been around, right? And she makes her friend makes her go to this fortune teller named Madame Gypsy, who tells her, oh no, you're gonna face a great evil. And again, this is another case where we have a huge comedy legend in this movie who doesn't have a great huge role, I don't think. I'm not sure, like, I think that they're maybe misused or they're just not given enough. And the Gypsy is played by Ruth Buzzi, who is an amazing actress. She did parts on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In in the 60s and 70s. And if people don't know that show, go watch it. It's comedy brilliance. And she plays the Gypsy. And she's memorable, but her lines are a little repetitive. And I don't think she's given really good jokes. It's sort of like, it's like, for a more modern reference, it's the Mallrats scene without the third nipple.
I couldn't get it out of my goddamn head. I was like, oh, I'm just looking for Jason Lee to pop out here and make a stupid joke.
Stupid joke. That's blasphemy. But yeah, no, I think
there's like no bite to that scene. Like there wasn't,
right.
It didn't even feel like there was any tension even being built from it. It was just like, mm-hmm. Okay, you just essentially told me the title of the movie again. I already knew the title of the movie. You didn't need to just tell me it through this weird psychic reading.
I agree with you. I think that you're totally right. I think a lot of the scenes, the problem is it's by the numbers and it's missing that bite. Like the reason why I remember the, I want to crawl up inside you and die is because it's so crazy that it's memorable and it caught me off guard, but there's a lot of other things that don't. And that's a problem. I think that that's one of the things that has kept this movie from rerunning on TNT versus Coneheads, right? Where there's a lot of beats, whether or not you loved it, there's a lot of beats that are there to remember. And I wish that it had had a little more, time on each scene to really work out some of the punchlines. Because I feel like there were a lot of punchlines that didn't, they just didn't land.
You gotta take off before you can land, sir.
Yeah.
Oh, that's unfair. Well, and here, so for film buffs who would find this interesting, here's yet another iconic comedy legend, Marcia Wallace from the Bob Newhart Show. She played his assistant, and I think everyone will know her as Miss Krabappel on The Simpsons, who passed away in 2013. She's a comedy genius. She's amazing. And she plays a hairdresser in a very short scene. In another one that I saw and I was like, there needs to be more. Like it just didn't land. And it felt like it was supposed to. It was a big beat. Basically, the mom goes into the salon. She's a human. She's getting her hair done. And she starts to transform by getting hair and everything, and she doesn't notice. And Marcia Wallace's character, the stylist, is like, oh, this will be my greatest transformation. And then gives her bigger hair and is like, look at you. And the mom sees that she's, you know, transforming into a werewolf and screams and runs out. And I'm like, where was the joke in there? Like, where's the beat? Like, Wolverine chic. Yeah, she's like, it's Wolverine chic. Okay, fair. That is the beat. And that was one in a scene, yeah. And I'm like, you have a comedy legend in there. And it's like having Lily Tomlin in and having her say, you know, like, here's your change, and giving her like the middle finger. Like it's a joke. And Lily Tomlin could probably pull it off, but you could have given her a lot more and a lot better.
The description of the joke is funnier than the joke.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. It's true. And I will say that I think the directing kind of failed on that part because in some of these, because it's just not very, it's serviceable, but it doesn't highlight a lot of the good stuff. Like, I didn't even, like, if Marcia Wall, excuse me, it's probably Marcia, didn't have such a recognizable face and voice, I probably would have missed her entirely. You know, and that's the same with Ruth Buzzi. If I didn't know, if she didn't have that like very strong chin that is so recognizable, I wouldn't have known her at all.
Yeah.
Let me point out a joke that did land for me.
Yes.
For me, only for me. And this is largely just because it's something that I'd totally hear in my daily life. And so therefore it was kind of funny because I'm like, oh God. So remember, she's in the bathroom shaving her legs, almost like in that poster, except that she was using an electric razor. So, and the daughter comes up and is like, what are you doing in there? You've been in there a half an hour. And the mom's just like, no, I'm not. No, I haven't. I've been in here only 30 minutes. And I'm like, that is something that my son would say. So it landed for me because I'm like, yeah, that's something that like family members would say. Just deadpan, like not even intending it to be a joke.
Yeah.
But it was.
Well, and that's the thing. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I feel like the script writer wasn't super humorous, and like even in that scene, I felt like the physical comedy element was like stronger. like the her playing around with all, like the hair on her legs and like putting the hair into the dude's mouth.
Yes, Ralph's mouth.
The earlier scene where she had like a bone or something, and like the old people were looking at her, and she was like chewing on this bone. Like,
I love that
stuff. Kind of got me way more than anything that was written down.
Sure, and that's I think we need to credit Susan Blakely with that, because she's given, and that's probably why the same reason John Saxon took the role. It was probably an opportunity that would be hard to come by elsewhere, right? There's a lot of physical comedy. There's a lot of physical action, and that scene you're talking about where she's still not sure that she still doesn't know that she's transforming into a werewolf. She just knows that she has big fangs and that she's really hungry for meat. So she goes to a deli and she picks up all this stuff, and she's driving, listening and singing to a rockabilly song on the radio while she's eating meat. And then she's chewing on this giant soup bone and pulls up at a stop sign next to this old couple who's like, look, a singing werewolf. Don't see too many of those these days. And they're both smiling and like happy to see it. And she like glances and smiles at him and drives away. Like, it's insanity. Like, and I agree that it works so much better because I think your cast, that's where you're letting the cast, which is stronger than some of the other elements, carry it.
Yeah.
And I mean, we haven't even gotten to the fact that her husband is played by John Shuck, who he's one of those faces, another one that is instantly recognizable, right? Like his face, you may not know where you know him from, but he's been in everything from Star Trek, The Voyage Home, to The Golden Girls, to The Mary Tyler Moore Show. He was in Dick Tracy. I mean, he's been in everything. He did a voice even in Freakazoid. And, he was, I will always think of him as Sheriff Tupper from Tales from the Crypt Demon Knight, because that was a fantastic film in my eyes. But he's been in a million things, and he's given a little bit, but not much, which is a shame because he is a very strong physical actor. Here's one line that I thought they gave him that stuck for the same reasons that the Pleasant Thought line stuck, is it's just so, it's like you know where they were going with the joke, but they didn't set it up right, so they're just expecting you to make this giant leap with them. Here it's near the end of the film. The Leslie's werewolf mom is fighting with, or the werewolf mom is fighting with John Saxon's werewolf in the bedroom, and the cops come, and at this point the husband, John Shuck, has walked in, seen it, and walked out with a literal makeup to white face. And so here's the cops running in with the husband behind.
That's my wife.
That animal is your wife?
Well, you have to get to know her.
It makes no sense. Like, it's a joke. Like, it is a joke. It's supposed to be like this interest, like this kind of misdirect. But the only interaction that has caused him to apparently say this is walking in, seeing a giant blonde werewolf, walking out with a white face, and then coming back in. It doesn't, his turn from like being shocked to somehow, that's my wife, ha ha ha, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all. It's like if they'd filmed this completely out of order and been like, here's a joke. The funny part is that you're like, you have to get to know her. And they filmed it out of order, that would have made sense as to their reactions. But the plot has no bearing on the reactions in many scenes in this film, in this movie.
So there's a, I'm sure you pointed out multiple times, there is a dissonance in a lot of the production overall in this movie.
Yeah.
And the more I watched it, the more I felt like this was a movie where someone probably had a you know, there was a fork in the road. They decided this is either going to be an erotic comedy or it's going to be a family film. And this movie sort of kind of tried to do both whilst keeping that family mentality so that they could
smash in the signpost in between.
Yeah. Basically, but I mean, like that, if think of it this way, if this movie was an erotic comedy, some of these jokes probably would have been easier for them to write and land better. But because it's a family film, you have to do that whole like Nickelodeon thing back in the day where all the adult jokes were very highly masked, and it worked great if you're competent at writing that. But
I think you have a point, because a lot of, like we said, we wish there was more edginess to the humor, but it is very subdued and the jokes tend to be jokes we've heard 1,001 times before. And so it probably is true that not even the cast is super excited about delivering them. And for screenwriter Mark Pirro's credit, he did do in 1987 a film that I enjoyed that is I think it's suitably better. It's a rated R film called Death Row Game Show, but it's a similar type of like, it's a tongue-in-cheek comedy that is very much in the horror vein. And I think it worked better there probably because he wasn't like, well, I'm going to have to neuter this because because he knew that film wasn't going to play to an all ages audience. And this one, some of the sexual stuff, like the mom is essentially going to have an affair and is in the John Saxon werewolf's bedroom and on the bed and totally down with it. Although,
Doing the foot fetish stuff.
He's like, and that the fact that that's how she gets infected with lycanthropy is he bites her toe, it's humorous, but the concept is humorous and the execution is not as humorous all the time. Although I did enjoy that scene in the bedroom. So they've basically he's run out on her from the lunch where he's seducing her, right? Because he sees fire or something. I like the touches, by the way. Like he brings his own silverware because he thinks that, and he says, I don't use silver utensils. It ruins the taste. And like, those are neat little touches, right? That it took thought to think of that, right? And you didn't have to do it. But then he sees fire and he flees the restaurant and goes back to the pet store. She gets stuck with the expensive bill and goes to give him a piece of her mind. Which is a pretty strong 180 from, yes, I will be unfaithful to my husband with you. And he's also using like his monster power charm on her, right? Like you don't know how much she's hypnotized versus how much she's willing to go along with this on her own. But they go into the pet store, or she goes into the pet store to look for him. She walks through the back room, and the back room is essentially a jungle, right? With like all sorts of weird animals. There's like an emu or an ostrich and a monkey in a cage who is very unhappy to be in a cage, I will tell you that right now, and tries very hard to get out. And there's just other creatures there. There's a tarantula, but it's just in this like foggy plant-filled swamp room. I'm not sure I understood that part, but off to one side, he has his bed. And then he seduces her yet again, and she lays down the bed, and he gives her drinks that have goldfish in them. Like, and her response to getting an alcoholic beverage with a goldfish in it is to look at it, pick the goldfish out, and fling it behind her. I assume it was not a real goldfish. And then just drink it. And then, do you want another? Yes, please, minus the fish. And you're just like, is no one going to react in this movie? Like, how? Like, what? Like, I didn't get it. And I didn't get it, but those are the scenes to me that actually were engaging because it was crazy. And yeah. I was like, I'll go with it. I'll go with it.
Yeah, I agree. Those were probably intentionally supposed to be funny, but like,
I think so.
Like, I don't know.
But if, I don't understand the logic.
If they landed the way that they were meant to, but yeah, like, it was just, yeah, the kind of the weirder and like the kind of the more, like even like less obviously funny it ended up being, like, the more funny it was to me is it was just like,
yeah,
this is just so, it just doesn't make any sense. I'm enjoying this for some reason.
Sure. It was sort of like a trauma film. Like, I always, my epitome of bad taste humor that I enjoyed is still probably the Toxic Avenger, you know, like where the bad guys, you know, run, you know, they hit a kid on a bicycle and then they back over his head in this gruesome crunching scene. And then he's like, what do you want to do now? He's like, I got to go home. I got church in the morning. You know what I mean? Like those things that are so like, they're so just, they make you just put your face in your like, hand.
Just
But those, they stick with me and they've always stuck with me. And I find it entertaining because you wait for the next part. And those are the things that they shine through in this movie in the few places where they're allowed. Because like the best friend who's kooky and is basically Blossom, but loves horror movies, right? Like the character, she's going to carry a lot. John Saxon's going to carry his part, but all the other pieces, they need something memorable to work. And we don't get those bizarre moments enough to carry it all the time. And you start to drift off and then you'll get a piece that will pull me back in. And then I'll start to drift off, you know, to return to something that Tad was saying, that there is a, uncomfortable amount for a for if this were to be a kids or family movie, amount of sexuality in this film, right? Especially even in the way it's shot, like when we see in the beginning, the film opens with Leslie, the mom, and her daughter driving home from the grocery store. The daughter takes the keys and goes in the house and apparently accidentally locks her mom out, and then her mom stumbles around for 5 minutes with the dog, going around to the back of the house, banging on the door, going in the door. The husband calls, says, "I'm not gonna be home for dinner," and then the daughter leaves to go to the convention with her friend, and the mom is just with the dog, bored at home. And when we go back to the mom after some other scenes, she's on the couch watching TV in a robe that is very open.
Very revealing.
Very revealing. And that was the first thing I was like, this would just be, it's just such a, like, you would never see Disney or Paramount or any of these things be like, this movie's going to be rated PG or even PG-13, and it's going to be a comedy for families, and we're going to show this woman's breast. It's just not going to happen, nipple or not. And it's just, it gives this movie the vibe that the people making it are not making these types of movies regularly. And they're not. These people are making rated R films on the average, and then they've made this movie.
Yeah.
And I think it points to that whole, like John Waters said, the neutering of the film in that way.
It's like, comic trying to do a clean bit, it's just
right. If you haven't worked it, and it's not, it's hard, and you'll end up like this happens in stand-up comedy, as a comedian. I see this. I actually guest ran for a while a clean show in a public forum in it was in Lake Forest, California, and it was in an open air mall, and it was a really weird scenario because the person who booked before me booked a lot of people who they didn't necessarily have clean sets. They said they can do a clean, instead of saying, "Do you have a clean set?" You'd say, "Could you do 30 minutes? It has to be clean." And what they do is they would just take their jokes and change the language so it wasn't, super nasty. And those jokes don't land because the content doesn't match the language. And your audience is also, it's a different audience, I guess, is the core of it, right? It's really, a clean set is probably not the same audience. Or if you're Jim Gaffigan or Jerry Seinfeld or somebody who's famous for it, you understand a clean set and you're going to kill no matter what. But if you don't, and you think you can just take your rated R movie and cut it down to a PG movie, you're going to be losing 90% of your skills.
Got people laughing in the first place, right?
Exactly. And I think that's what happened here. And I want to reiterate, I actually think that this film should be watched by people who love 80s comedies or even early 90s comedies, because this one really is on the line. You can tell from the poster that it's like right on the edge, right? Like Jennifer's outfit is like, it's either, it looks almost like it's a denim jumpsuit, even though it's not. You know what I mean? With the white belt, the bangs, the whole thing is super 90s. And I do appreciate the movie poster. The movie poster probably sold more tickets than any word of mouth, because it's exactly what you'd expect. Like, oh my gosh, these long legs attract viewers, and then she's a werewolf. She has to shave because ladies have to shave, and now she has more hair. Wah, 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 wah. Like, it's, and it works. And you've got the gypsy and everybody who you care to see on the poster, except for John Saxon, and he's then the candy that you get when you actually go to see the movie.
So Nate, when I was young, and I hadn't mentioned this, when you put this in the rotation, I was like, "Oh, you've got to be fucking kidding me! That movie," because I was well versed with this movie when I was a kid. Because when I was young, and my parents had first gotten cable, there were certain channels that were just preview channels. Like it would just run you through a bunch of trailers, and this one played all the goddamn time. And even the marketing back then, it clearly was sort of geared towards trying to trick people into thinking that it was an erotic comedy with a horror tint. And
that's hilarious.
It's not at all. Even though it clearly had the bones of an erotic comedy in there, it just, someone along the line, I swear, someone just went, "No, we can't do this. It won't make money. Make it a family movie."
Yep.
I don't know kind of how you do it. Just do it.
Well, and again, the Mark Pirro and the director, Michael Fisher, they made movies before this that were you know, solidly in the horror realm, sort of tongue-in-cheek horror, but they were in the horror realm, and they did make money, I think. And so I'm sure that it was, actually Death Spa came sort of after this, but I think that the idea was, is, hey, these guys know what they're doing to make money, so how about you do something for the kids? But anyone that isn't a producer and thinks for 2 seconds knows that that does not necessarily make sense. And I think with this movie, I think that it, I'm going to hazard a guess and say that it probably made money because it looks right on paper. You know what I mean? Like the poster's on point. If you walked into a theater that was playing it, and then walked out after 30 seconds, you would think it's exactly the kind of movie it is trying to be.
This has got to sell like or rent VHSs or whatever.
Absolutely. This was still the video boom. So they were just like, here, you have to make movies. For example, three of, I keep forgetting his name, Michael Fish's movies came out in 1989. Two other films came out at the same time, Death Spa and a movie called Crack House, which was an action crime movie. So with Jim Brown, by the way, who I met, who is a nice fella. So at least to me. So it's, they were churning out material, you know, it was the pre Netflix boom of film, and they didn't really care so much what the content was all the time, so long as it looked right, because it would make money. In this case, I don't think I would have been disappointed necessarily as a kid had I bought this movie and I watched it. I think that I would have known instinctively that it was not,
top echelon of
it's not, you know, this is no Breakfast Club, but there's nothing beyond the surface, but it's entertaining, and the music in this movie makes me happy. And I'm not talking about the orchestral soundtrack, and I use orchestral tongue-in-cheek because it is not orchestral, but the soundtrack itself is goofy, like a like this kind of like cartoony kind of thing. But the music tracks that they use from bands are great. It's got this rockabilly, classic rock and roll kind of vibe. And I'm really sad that the soundtrack is not available or long out of print. I've been searching. I haven't found it. But there are, you know, you can find the individual tracks. It's, you know, Ronald Blackwell with Midnight Ride. Barry Fassman, like you've got some real good rock and roll, and I totally recommend people who like that sort of 56 Chevy rockabilly stuff to check out the soundtrack, if nothing else. Right. So I think we're at that time. I'm interested to hear the takes. Tad, who would you recommend this movie to and why?
People who just like that 80s, 90s vibe, because, well, unless you are a movie with house party aficionado, which of course has to have an obligatory house party. But yeah, I also appreciated the guy dancing around in the Nixon mask. But
the party scene, and just as a note, the party scene is great. It's the epitome of every party scene. In an 80s, 90s movie, even all the way up to now, if you watch, you know, Sorority House Massacre, those things, like every party scene is this. It's just people who look completely like they never would look in real life, jumping up and down while a soundtrack plays. And
we even live in Spider-Man.
Oh yeah, it's true. and it works. So Jeff, who would you recommend this film to?
Yeah, I suppose if you've watched like, I don't know, like 15, like, you know, of the best 80s comedies and you still need more, go see this film, you know, like that's,
you know, glowing recommendation.
Clearly you needed more if you got through all that. You know, yeah, it really was fun. Like I can't say I loved it, but I definitely didn't hate it. It kind of went right in the middle there where it was, you know, yeah, it made me smile a couple times, and there was even a couple times I laughed out loud. So
I think you both are getting down to something, which is what I'm going to recommend this for, is if you just need a moment of escapism. This is a real tough time right now. A lot of people are having trouble financially, health-wise, with their personal and civil liberties. If you just need an hour and a half to just watch something that will not make you hurt inside and will quiet the brain for a little bit, check out My Mom's a Werewolf. You can find it. It's out there. And I really recommend it for that. It's not going to tax you. Okay, you're going to be able to go to bed without thinking about it, and hopefully you'll be able to go to bed and rest peacefully so you can tackle all the hard stuff you got to do the next day. All right.
Unless you're doing a podcast about it, and then you got to remember the things, you got to take them with you.
Exactly. You got to listen. You got to watch it again. You got to take out audio extracts that mean something to the audience. You got to fight the tech battle with Zoom. Yep. Absolutely. All these things. All right. So thanks guys so much. As always, thank you to the Chud for our intro and outro music. Here, we're going to play out with All About Evil. Want to remind everyone that the clips used in this show are for review purposes only. And if you would like to support the Chud, you can find them at facebook.com/thechudband. You can also support Cult and Classic Podcast by donating at cultandclassicpodcast.com. And we look forward to seeing you, or rather hearing you, next week. Join the Patreon. We love you so much, and have a good day. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to Cult and Classic Podcast. This podcast is important to me, but what's more important are the rights, privileges, and freedom from violence of everyone in this country and in this world. And that means supporting Black Lives Matter. If you'd like to make a donation, please go ahead and visit cultandclassicpodcast.com, where we have a list of places you can donate and help out. And please stay safe.